What causes a man to stand on a cold and sometimes unforgiving stage, telling jokes, and looking for the approval of strangers? Iowa comedian Nathan Timmel will tell you it was his upbringing. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In the first half hour, my guest is Iowa stand-up comedian and author Nathan Timmel. His memoir is titled, I Was a White Knight, Once. Timmel has performed many times for U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. Then in the second half hour, we'll listen back to my conversation from 2008 with Lauren Reese Flom, who died recently. In 2008, Flom was the grand prize winner when Red Book magazine asked its readers to send in their stories of how breast cancer had touched their lives. It's all coming up. First, this news. What causes a man to stand on a cold and sometimes unforgiving stage, telling jokes and looking for the approval of strangers? My first guest today will tell you it was his upbringing. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Nathan Timmel is a stand-up comedian who lives in Iowa, actually a resident of North Liberty, with his wife. And in addition to his appearances at comedy clubs across the country, Nathan Timmel has performed many times for U.S. troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. His self-published memoir is titled, I Was a White Knight Once, an uncommon memoir. It's one of Amazon Kindle's top-rated memoirs, and Nathan Timmel joins us for this first half hour. Good afternoon to you, Nathan. Welcome back.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Nice to be here.
One of the many highlights of this memoir are the parts in which you talk about what it's like to perform for the troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. In a way, you are Iowa's our Bob Hope, I guess you could say. Can you start off by reading a section of your book about an experience you had in either Iraq or Afghanistan?
Absolutely. The segment I picked is from Afghanistan, and where I pick it up is we were in Kandahar, another comedian and I.
And this is about what year?
2005. Mm-hmm. And what while we were in Kandahar, we had the unfortunate honor of attending a ramp ceremony where a U.S. soldier had fallen, and they were being put on a plane and sent back home to a waiting mother or father or wife, something like that. And what we didn't know as we were standing there watching this is within a couple days, maybe the next day or the day after, we were flown to the base that soldier was at and told to do a comedy show. And that's where I pick up right now is right there. One of our first stops was the outpost of the fallen soldier whose ramp ceremony we had just attended. Paul and I were flown in around 9 a.m. for a 10 a.m. performance. Most everyone was asleep, as they had just gotten back from an overnight patrol. They had searched for the insurgents that had killed their friend. Tensions were high, considering the ambush and the loss they had just faced, so the commanding officer informed us he was going to issue an order of attendance for the comedy show. This news made me uneasy, as not only was the current situation already not too ideal, but mandatory turnout brings in a reluctant audience. The show was to be performed at the base headquarters in what served as the recreation room. This headquarters turned out to be a small Afghani home, with the recreation room in essence a converted living room that was maybe 15 by 30 feet at best. Slowly, 20 tired soldiers with sleep-deprived eyes made their way in to sit wherever they could, which meant mostly on the floor. Some of the faces seemed so very, very young to me. Being 19 or 20 might make you an adult by default, but when I think about what I was dealing with at that age, compared to the enormous stress and pressure those in front of me were living with daily, words do fail. Though exhausted and forced to be there, those 20 soldiers made a damn fine audience. Over the course of my act, they smiled, then laughed, then eventually applauded as their body posture went from rigid to relaxed. Their commander was a veteran, and he knew that sometimes youth has to be told how to deal with stress. Even though they had lost a brother in arms, someone most likely a close friend, they were still alive. Even if comedy seemed like the most inappropriate thing in the world, they needed to understand they still had laughter inside them.
Nathan Timmel reading from his memoir, I Was a White Knight Once, an Uncommon Memoir. So you touch on it there in that reading, giving us the scene of that. But you were there to entertain the troops, make them laugh for a few minutes, and you're flown from the United States over there. You're choptered around in Black Hawk helicopters around these two countries when you did that. Did you ever question the value of being paid to do that?
Yeah, I question the value of all of it sometimes, because you read stories of a $1,000 hammer and military waste and money being poured here and there, and suddenly you realize that you are technically part of that waste. It's like, what could this money being used to fly me? You know, there are times when it's you and the other comic on a Black Hawk helicopter, and you're thinking, okay, this is exclusive for us. We are taking a very expensive taxi. And then you just have to put it out of your mind, because you talk to the soldiers and it's embarrassing how thankful they are. I mean, you feel just so humiliated and humble, because they're shaking your hand and saying, thank you for coming over here and making me laugh. And in my mind, all I'm thinking is, I get to leave in 10 days. You are here serving the country. Don't thank me. But they every time I say that and feel embarrassed, a soldier or a veteran will say, shut up. Don't even think that way. You get us through those long nights. Just the moments of thinking that, or remembering the act, or, you know, laughing an hour later or a few days later, just remember, that's where the value comes in, is basically morale, trying to let them know that they are remembered and respected.
In fact, one of the quotes that jumped out at me from your memoir is right on this. You performed, and one of the people in the audience was a female soldier named Leah. And she says, sitting in the theater in the darkness, just laughing, I actually forgot where I was for a second. I was just laughing and then looked down and saw my uniform. I looked around and actually wondered why everyone was in military garb for a moment, and then I remembered how far from home I was. But for a second, I forgot.
I can tell you right now, that was Camp Anaconda in Iraq. I remember that. It's just, I forget almost everything in my life, but there are a few things that I will take with me to my deathbed. And I remember her name. I hid it in the book there, but I remember her last name, and I remember the theater we were performing in, and it was outside. Just to be told that what you were doing made someone forget all their problems for just a second, it's powerful.
Mm. As a professional comedian, and you've been a professional comedian for how many years?
About 14 now.
14 years. You go to it's been many years since you did your first gig that was in Iraq, right?
Yeah, 2004 was my first time there. I think 2010 was my last.
Your first tour. So what would you say now, summing up, were the main differences in performing for a military audience compared to one at a comedy club here in the United States?
Oh, this could take up the entire hour if you really wanted to break it down. It can go either way. One difference could be the military audience literally in a place like that has nothing better to do. They have nothing to do, because in Iraq or Afghanistan, they can't go off base. They can't get drunk. They can't. So when you show up, it's just like, oh, my God, something different other than staring at sand and rocks. Whereas in the States, it's, hey, let's get drunk and yell at the comic on stage. Or, you know, they got dragged up by their girlfriend and they're going to sit there with their arms crossed. And but then to flip that a complete 180, military audiences can be, because they are trained to be soldiers. They're soldiers. They can be very rigid. They can sit and sort of smile the entire show without laughing once. And you're thinking, my God, they hate me. And afterwards, they'll come up to you and say, that was the funniest thing I ever saw. But they're trained to be controlled, so they're not going to laugh. I mean, and then you go to a show in the States, and everybody's just relaxed because they're not in a hostile territory. They are drinking, so they're just going to laugh and clap and applaud. I mean, you can get laughter out of military troops easily, but I'm saying sometimes you will end up with that audience where they're just going to sit, and they're having a great time, but they're, you know, almost sitting at attention, rigid body posture, enjoying themselves.
Yeah, that you looking for feedback as a stand-up comedian, I imagine that is disconcerting unless you're
until
familiar.
You get used to
until
it.
You,
yes.
Until you get used to it. My guest, if you just joined us, is Nathan Timmel, a stand-up comedian who lives in North Liberty, Iowa, And he's a new memoir out. It's called I Was a White Knight Once, an uncommon memoir, one of Amazon Kindle's top-rated memoirs. Let's talk a little bit about some of the other things that you have in your book, if we could, Nathan. This memoir asks the question, what causes a man to stand on a cold and sometimes unforgiving stage, telling jokes, looking for the approval of strangers? And you say your answer to that is your upbringing. What about your upbringing made you turn to stand-up comedy?
I don't think it's just mine. I hate to be unoriginal, but it's almost a stand-up comic upbringing in general, where me personally, I moved 10 times before I was 10 years old. Without being told, I learned that friendship doesn't last because every time I would make a friend, I would lose it. So I began to use comedy as either a weapon or a shield, depending. I would either attack the other classmates with humor, like, hey, everybody like me because I'm funny. Or if I was in a situation where something painful was happening, it was a shield where it's like, aha, you didn't get to me. I'm going to make everyone laugh, or I'm going to make a joke out of it. Mm-hmm. And
you say in your book that you call the stage in your book your drug of choice. How similar is it to an addiction?
I would almost think I go through withdrawal if it's that fixation, the need for attention. Some people might not acknowledge it, but it's that I have mommy and daddy issues, and maybe they didn't hug me enough, so I need the audience to respond to me, because if they're not, then nobody loves me, even though, you know, I know that's fake. But, I mean, Nikki Sixx, the bassist for Motley Crue, he was abandoned by his parents, and he was, at the time, I think it was the Theater of Pain or Girl, when you read his book, just a huge, huge, famous musician, and he's still mired in drug addiction because mommy and daddy left me. I don't understand what's going on in my childhood. So as much as you can acknowledge it, okay, I didn't have a great childhood, somewhere in the back of your mind, you can't get over it, and so
understanding it doesn't get you over it either.
So Nikki Sixx was a world-famous rock star but still turned to drugs. I can acknowledge my issues, but still have to stand on stage. And if a joke bombs, I'm thinking, oh, why don't they like me? Let's get them with the next one.
And you've never wanted to get over that?
I think you can come to terms with it. I think that I'm healthy with it. I think you can become friends with it. If that's called getting over it, acknowledging it, I think it's when you deny it or don't acknowledge it or pretend it doesn't exist. That's when it's a painful addiction.
You acknowledge in this memoir that your parents did not have a happy marriage. They broke up. And one of the things you write in the book was this. They agree on nothing. So when in separate moments, both wistfully turned their head, looked into the distance and said, in the seventh grade, you stopped smiling. What happened in the seventh grade?
I don't really know, but I think I moved too many times. What you're talking about is to write this book, I interviewed both of my parents extensively. I wanted to make sure I got as much correct or as factually correct as possible. And they would always say, well, your mother did this, your father did this. No, this is the way it happened. No. So I moved so often when I was a child, when each one of them said, in seventh grade, you stopped smiling. You used to be this happy, vivacious young child, and in seventh grade, you gave up. And I think that was, I think I moved too often. I think I had learned one too many times, all right, I don't need to make friends because we always move, and I don't keep friends because this was before the internet. We're going back to the 70s and early 80s, so unless you were pen pals with someone or running up an enormous phone bill, you didn't have cell phones. So it was very difficult to stay in touch with people. So I just lost friends, and what I think was in seventh grade, I gave up and shut down internally. I was a child being told to deal with, you're starting over again.
A little later in your life, in fact, the book is titled after one of the chapters in the book. You describe your 20s and the relationship you had then with this title of the book, I Was a White Knight Once. What does that mean?
For me personally, I think watching my parents' unhappy marriage meant that when I entered into romantic situations in my early 20s, definitely, and well, most of my 20s, I found damaged women that I wanted to rescue. I would find women that were insecure or felt badly about themselves, and I wanted to tell them, you deserve better than this. Here, I will love you. Let me show you that you are a beautiful woman. Maybe I was trying to fix my parents' marriage or somehow talk to my mother through very, different relationships. So I found a very, very damaged woman who was dating a man who abused her and dealt drugs and cheated on her. And we got wrapped up into a years-long romantic relationship where she wouldn't leave him, but she was dating me on the side, and everything just ended in disaster. And fortunately, I walked away from that learning, you know what, I need to find someone that is mature and has dealt with issues on her own. I can't save people, so that's the title. I used to consider myself a white knight. I will swoop in and rescue the fair maiden who needs it, and you know, I finally met someone that, you know what, you have everything together. You're an adult. I'm an adult. Let's just approach this relationship like adults.
Nathan Timmel, we have a few minutes left before we have to say goodbye, but I wonder if you would read us something else from your book, a little different facet of your book. You live in North Liberty with your wife, Lydia, and as you say, you live also with two kitties, one female, one gender confused, and a dog named Kitty. I wonder if you could read something you've written in the book about your home life. A lot of funny things here, just interesting things.
Yeah, well, the section I got here for the end, it's, I don't know that it's funny, but it ties in with the comfort of a relationship. I went through, the title of the book is named after a damaged relationship, so this is one that's more comfortable. This is my wife and something I didn't know about her. At bedtime, I generally fall asleep while my wife reads whatever it is she's currently using to expand her mind. A book, Time or Fitness magazine, a Harlequin romance novel, something. What's strange is, before cohabitation, I usually had to be completely exhausted in order to sleep. If I wasn't, I would just sit wherever I was with thoughts bouncing around my noggin. But something about lying in bed with Lydia makes me relaxed enough to drift off when I'm only nominally tired. I like that. A few months into our cohabitation, she asked, "Do you feel me rest my hand on you when I finally turn out the light?" Surprised, I responded that I did not. Lydia informed me that when she sets aside her book and settles in for bed, her first sleep position involves touching me in some way. A rested hand, an arm draped across me, or her head nuzzled into the back of my neck, depending on how I happened to be facing, of course, which was usually turned away from her reading light. Again, I was surprised. I'm a fairly light sleeper. So a couple nights after she told me that, I lied. I rolled onto my side while she read, and then gradually changed my breathing pattern. I deepened my breaths, slowed them to an almost unhurried pace, and feigned sleep. I'm not sure how long she read, but after the light went off, I felt a warm body nestle up behind me, throw an arm over my side, and let loose all tension from the day. And I thought, wow.
Nathan Timmel, reading from I Was a White Knight Once, his memoir. You use a lot of course, as any comedian, a lot of your personal life out on stage and make fun of it. You have a lot of jokes that are sexual in nature, a lot of other types of jokes. Do you have an agreement with your wife that you ask her about something that may happen at home, that if you can use it on stage? Or
no, she's really good about that. She only has asked me to censor one joke, and that was only one time when her grandparents were in the audience, and it was something involving our sex life that I found funny and felt the need to share with audiences of unsuspecting listeners. But she asked me to withhold it just while they were in the audience, and I did.
And just for that one performance?
Just for that one. And she has asked me, I just did the joke in front of her over the weekend at a comedy club in Cedar Rapids, Penguins. For a while, she was asking me not to say. She is 4 weeks from having her first baby, and now she tinkles when she sneezes because she is at that point where the baby. So she said, "Don't talk about that." And I absolutely had to talk about that. And so I did break the rule, but she was fine with it because that's not that graphic. It's just more embarrassing. But you just giggled. I mean, it is funny to think that she'll go, "Oh, just ah," you know.
Well, the part of the memoir that's as funny, if not more, is when she points out to you that, well, perhaps you can describe it. You've got an interesting way of drying yourself off when you come out of the shower.
See, I don't think it's interesting. The you just mentioned a point in the book where a lot of people seem to fixate on it. When I get out of the shower, I dry off with a towel, except for my bottom. I take toilet paper and I dry out my bottom using toilet paper. And for some reason, you brought it up, and a lot of people, I just think it's natural. I do not want to use a towel back there and then the next day think, as I'm drying off my face, hey, is this where I just, you know, I don't think it's unusual, but apparently people seem to think otherwise.
And your wife, Lydia, thinks otherwise, because what does she say to you?
I don't remember. She thinks I'm an idiot on many levels, but...
She says something, if I'm remembering the memoir.
What's the problem, Nathan? She just used it to do that, so yes.
She's saying, what's the problem, Nathan? You just got out of the shower. Isn't it clean? It's clean.
It's clean, and she has used that very towel to wipe her nether regions dry, and here I am being a prude about it. That's a good point. I'd forgotten that.
Many parts of this book, Nathan, are funny, hilarious. Others are serious. Did you mean this to be a comedy book? Is it what you set out to do in the beginning, or did it turn into something completely different?
No, when I stand on stage, I better be funny. The audience is coming to a comedy club or a comedy show, and they want funny. So I specifically set this book out as a way of talking about other things that might not be so funny. And when I am promoting it on stage, I even say, hey, I've got a memoir here. Now, it is a memoir. I don't want you to think that it's all comedy. There are funny points in it, but it's again, it's sort of a cliche. It's the sad clown comedian. It's Robin Williams saying, I want to do Good Will Hunting. I want to do, you know, win an Oscar. It's Jim Carrey saying, I want to do the number 23. I don't always want to be seen as funny. I don't know what it is about us, but, you know, when you're a comedian, you want to, I have a serious side too, damn it. You know, and so this was specifically set out to tell other stories that don't have to generate laughter. I do that on stage.
What would you say? We've just got a couple minutes left, but what would you say are the biggest misconceptions? People dream about being a stand-up comedian, but 90-whatever percent of us don't have the guts to try it. What is the biggest misconception you find people have who've never done it?
That being funny gets you somewhere in this business. That if you are original and funny, that you will go far. People naturally assume that. That's one thing. Another thing is if they have a comedy club in their local city and they think I'm funny, they say, hey, why don't you come play the comedy club? As if I should just call them up and say, hey, I'm a comedian. They'll go, oh, we're going to book you, kid. It's like any other industry. There are politics involved. You will get booked easier if you have a TV credit so that you can put on a poster as seen on than you will by having years of experience or being funny and original.
Connections matter.
Yes.
Promotion matters. Finally, there's a picture of you in the book standing on the shoulder of a huge statue of who I think is Saddam Hussein.
Yes.
You look like a Lilliputian in Gulliver's Travels. You're this minute thing standing on the shoulder of this huge statue. Where is that? Or where was that? Has it been ripped out?
I believe trying to save. There were four of them, and there were three left when we saw them. They were being demolished by rioters or people overthrowing when we were moving in. That's just the vanity of Saddam Hussein. He built these enormous busts of his own head, his own profile, and set them. I'm not around the city. I'm not sure where, but I wanted to take a picture with one before they were destroyed.
You can find it in Nathan Timmel's memoir. It's titled I Was a White Knight Once, an Uncommon Memoir. And Nathan Timmel, we've got to go.
Everything is on my website, nathantimmel.com.
Thank you very much for coming into our studio and joining us, Nathan. And good luck to you and your wife with a baby coming in a few weeks and becoming a father.
Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment on River to River, we listen back to my conversation from 2008 with Lauren Reese Flom, who died recently at her home in Iowa City. In 2008, Flom was the grand prize winner when Red Book magazine asked its readers to send in their stories of how breast cancer had touched their lives. That's coming up after a short break. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. And finally today, a remembrance. I've been privileged to speak with many remarkable people over the years on this program, none more remarkable than Lauren Reese Flom. Earlier this month, she passed away. Lauren had been living with breast cancer for 17 years and died at her home in Iowa City, surrounded by family. Lauren was a community leader and a community builder. She also had many other passions, which she shared generously with those around her. Having worked as a pastry chef to New York City Mayor Ed Koch, she loved to share her culinary talents with others. A lifetime lover of theater, Lauren directed several children's plays at her synagogue and at Iowa City's Youth Theater. Lauren was also an accomplished writer who focused much of her material on living with cancer. In 2008, the essay she wrote about her experience was the grand prize winner among thousands of entries when Red Book magazine asked its readers to send in their stories of how breast cancer had touched their lives. That essay was also chosen to lead off a collection of 46 personal essays by women whose lives were changed by their fight with and their triumph over cancer, called A Cup of Comfort for Breast Cancer Survivors. I spoke with Lauren Rees-Flom back in 2008, soon after that national recognition. So today, we want to listen back to excerpts from that talk. Also, joining a little later in the conversation, Colleen Sell, editor of the book A Cup of Comfort for Breast Cancer Survivors. Here's the way my visit with Lauren Rees-Flom started when she came into our studio in 2008. I'd like you to tell us about your essay, to have you share some of that, read a little bit of it, and we'll talk a little bit about that. This is an essay about someone who became very dear to you, a nurse at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics who treated you while you were undergoing chemotherapy. Perhaps before you read the excerpt, tell us when you were diagnosed with breast cancer.
I was originally diagnosed in 1995.
Mm-hmm.
I had a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old. And this nurse, Inga, at that time, I believe she was a nurse for one of the doctors who you would see in the clinic. And then she became a nurse in the chemotherapy suite. And I came and she nursed me during 2 different rounds of chemotherapy. And so I got to know her quite well.
Would you read a little bit of your essay here, a beautiful essay, actually the first essay in this collection of 46 essays, a dedication, an ode to Inga, if you will.
Sure. Thank you, Ben. And this comes from the middle of the essay. I've been in and out of the chemotherapy suite for 12 years now. Besides the nurses and the aides and the volunteer coffee ladies, I'm the rare person that continues to call the chemo suite my home away from home. 12 years in and out of those antiseptic doors, rounds and rounds of drugs, whose lists of just the side effects take the nurses 15 minutes to recite. Nausea, vomiting, hair loss, skin changes, headache, diarrhea, fever, chills, bruising, achy bones, itchy skin, toe fungus, shortness of breath, blurred vision, compromised motor control, loss of appetite, and not to mention the swift and premature departure of any sense of personal well-being and peace of mind. And that's supposed to be the good news, the things that happen when the chemo is working. But Inga, always Inga, made it better. Each Thursday, she reserved my favorite bed by the window with the view of the gray parking ramp and the grayer Iowa skies. She padded into and out of the room in hushed tones. She spoke descriptively in a soothing whisper, and she spoke only when necessary. Inga didn't laugh at me the time I brought in a stack of bills to pay during chemo. And she didn't bat an eye when I couldn't even hold the pen between my fingers when signing the first check and she was left to gather the tumbled bills at my bedside. She didn't panic, like her colleagues did, the time the tubing unhinged from the IV pump while I was asleep and blood and chemo fluid flooded the floor. I will never forget waking up to a half dozen nurses dressed in garments like from Three Mile Island cleaning up the spill. Inga was the mother of two, older daughter, younger son, just like me, and her two were a couple of years ahead of mine in school. During the summers, when I would leave my kids home alone so I could go get the chemo, she would leave hers home alone so she could give it to me. We would laugh together, musing at the state the house would be in at the end of the day, chores undone, empty pizza boxes open on the countertop, the potential of a summer's day squandered in front of the squawking TV. Beneath my laughter, I'd envy the sense of security Inga's children had. Their mother heading out in the morning in nursing scrubs and sensible shoes, strong and ready to help people suffering from cancer, versus the insecurity my children were dealt, their mother sick with cancer coming home sicker from treatment. I envied that truth of Inga's life, along with all that I admired in her cool competence, her quiet authority, and her deep, calming heart. Mostly, I envied Inga and her family that feeling of everyday life before becoming aware of its tragic unfolding in one's own backyard.
Iowa City resident Lauren Reese Flom reading from her essay titled Inga, the first essay in a total of 46 featured in A Cup of Comfort for Breast Cancer Survivors, a new book, a collection of inspiring stories of courage and triumph. And tell us, Lauren, it was not long after this, as your essay continues, it was not long after this, I think you'd been done with chemotherapy for a while, when Inga herself became ill.
Yes, she did. And I remember being going into the hospital just for a routine checkup and hearing from one of the nurses that Inga had been quite sick and that she was on disability and she wasn't coming into work. And she had been diagnosed with a rare cancer of the tongue, which was very devastating. And she lost the ability to eat very quickly and then to speak. Mm-hmm. And then I believe I think she survived a few years. Her daughter Susan told me recently it was a couple of years. And then she died.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, when the nurse dies and the patient recovers, it's very devastating.
Last year, last fall, I believe in 2007, there was a painting of a nurse dedicated mm-hmm. in memory of Inga. And you were asked to speak at that event at the University of Iowa Hospitals.
I had written a letter just to the Press Citizen in praise of Inga when she died, and the people organizing this ceremony asked me to come in and read it. And like I said, I know these people. I've been there in and out those doors a long time. And so there was a lovely ceremony, and it was all the oncology nurses and physicians, and I read my letter, and Inga's daughter, Susan, and Inga's husband and son were also there, and it was very touching.
You point out in your essay the likeness between her daughter, that you thought you were looking at a younger version of Inga.
Oh, it's unbelievable. Yeah, it's just like, oh, my God, there's Inga. Just her aura and her persona were so much like her mother's. She herself was a comfort.
Lauren Reese Flom, recorded in 2008. She died earlier this month at her home in Iowa City. Also in on that conversation with Lauren in 2008, Colleen Sell, editor of the book A Cup of Comfort for Breast Cancer Survivors. I asked Colleen why she had chosen Lauren's essay to lead off the collection of 46 essays by women whose lives were changed by breast cancer.
Well, a couple things. Probably the most important that it was the only story I received that of the 3,000 that was about a caretaker, a nurse or a doctor. A lot of the stories mentioned them, but they weren't focused on it. And it was just such an unusual twist that, you know, here Lauren is fighting for her life for so many years because she had recurring bouts of breast cancer. And this wonderful nurse who was so attentive, so compassionate, so good at her job, falls to a different kind of cancer. And that twist, sort of the duo compassion, you know, from both Lauren and from Inga, their caring for one another, really touched me. This is a very intimate disease, breast cancer. People who are being treated, you know, it just touches you in such an intimate way, both the treatment and just how it affects your life, that all of these stories touch on that intimacy, that it hit you right to the core, right in your soul. And this really was the story. Inga was so full of soul, so full of that compassion for one another.
Yeah, you point out in your introduction that each of these stories is very different, many different perspectives here on from breast cancer survivors, but they do have something in common, all of them.
They do. And I think they actually have a couple things in common. One is just the power of the human spirit, that these women rise up. I mean, they rise up and take charge of their lives, and they move forward with such courage and hope and resilience. It's astounding. The other thing that I think runs through all these stories is that there's sort of a sisterhood, and even beyond that, that there are special relationships in our life that really help us when we're going through something difficult like breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing that common thread through the stories is that there is life during breast cancer and also after breast cancer. That really hit home with me when I read all 3,000 of the stories, and then particularly these 46, that there is life, that above and beyond breast cancer there is life, and we need to hold on to that.
Mm-hmm. You have edited a number of books. Has breast cancer touched your life, your family's life in any way?
It has, and you know, it's bound to touch everyone's life in some respect, because 1 in 8 women are diagnosed with breast cancer sometime in their life. Yes, my mother had breast cancer when I was very young. I think I was 10 or 11, and she survived it. She's still surviving it. And I remember how scary it was as a little girl with 4 younger brothers and sisters wondering, is my mommy going to make it?
Lauren, in your instance, when you were diagnosed with breast cancer many years ago, what was that moment like? Can you take us back to that moment?
Well, I can. It was 13 years ago, and I also had young children, and I found a lump on my own just one day, and went to the doctor, and she pulled some fluid out, and she said she couldn't get any fluid, and then I had a biopsy, and I got the call from that doctor, and at that moment, my entire life was turned upside down.
How? What were the thoughts, the shift that took place?
Well, you think you're just living regular life. You know, you're living your life, and like Colleen said, I mean, you don't plan on it, and all of a sudden, the power of that word cancer, it just flips everything over. It flips all your priorities. It changes all your plans. It sifts through your relationships very quickly, mm-hmm. and it cuts to the core of who am I and how am I going to cope with this thing?
Sifts through your relationships quickly. What does that mean?
It was my experience that people that I knew, some people that I didn't know well at all, really rose to try to come to my side and help me. People really that I had distant relationships with, and they just stepped forward and they were willing to give me their time. They ran errands, they cooked, they took care of my kids. You know, people really stepped up. Mm. And when you have cancer, you realize how precious your time is, and when you see that people are willing to give you their time, that's very moving.
So it wasn't that they came and necessarily talked with you. They asked, what do you need and how can I help?
Yes, and that's the best approach, to actually ask the person who's in need. A lot of people presume and try and try to figure out what it is you may want. That's less effective than actually just asking the person.
First of all, listening.
First of all, absolutely, listening is my number one. You know, you asked me earlier, you know, what helped you, what got you through, and I said kindness got me through it. But I think number one on the kindness list is just the listening,
mm-hmm.
and pure listening, listening without advice, listening without trying to make it better, just absolute open ears and empathy.
The language of the disease, the communication here that happens, Lauren, a lot of new lingo comes into your head when you get breast cancer. How did you deal with that?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and it is. You have to learn a new language. It is an entirely new language, and nobody teaches it to you, and it gets thrown at you when you're at your most vulnerable, mm-hmm. and it's frightening, and you don't understand it. Personally, I'm very fortunate. I'm married to a physician who at least knew how to go about trying to describe what some of those words meant.
Mm-hmm.
I have found that nurses are much better than doctors at talking to patients in a language that they understand. So find a nurse, find your doctor's nurse, and just talk your language, and most likely the nurse will be able to really explain things.
Mm-hmm. Because in this type of care, undergoing care, the nurse is the one you have by far the most contact with.
Absolutely, especially if you're an inpatient or if you're in the chemotherapy suite. It's the nurses who really take care of you. And I think nurses have a much better feel for what the patient is going through emotionally. Not to say that doctors don't, but I think they're the ones who put the time into the talking and the listening and the answering of the questions.
It was interesting, too, Lauren, you turned your energy as a breast cancer survivor to improving something that you saw lacking in your treatment. It has to do with music. Tell us briefly about that.
Well, when you go to the chemotherapy suite here in Iowa City at the university, you sit in a chair and it's crowded and there's people sitting in those chairs all around you and everybody's in a tough, challenging place. Everyone's getting very difficult medications. And the only quote-unquote distraction there is a television set that's kind of shared amongst different people in these chairs. And it's, you know, some people just don't want to be watching television, but then the sound kind of pervades your area. And so I've always found that to be a big problem. So I was approached by Elizabeth Oakes from the Maya Quartet. And together, we've put together a program in conjunction with the Holden Comprehensive Cancer Center and the UI Department of Behavioral Health called Sweet Sounds. And we are in the process of recording all different kinds of music and meditation tapes and literature, short stories, essays, onto iPods that will be available with high-quality headsets for patients while they're getting chemotherapy. We started with a survey of patients to see what it was that they might like to listen to. Mm-hmm. And interestingly enough, short stories came up first. And meditation was quite high on there.
Short stories necessarily having to do with breast cancer?
Not necessarily, although we didn't really go past that. Just people wanting the distraction of a story and the pleasure of literature.
So the worst, the thing you're trying to avoid is just being alone in the waiting room with your fears.
Yes, it's not for the waiting room. It's in the chemo suite itself you're getting medicated, while you're receiving the meds are pouring into your veins and you've got something to take your mind off exactly what's happening. And people were interested in classical music, country music, and so now we have someone in the Department of Music Therapy uploading all these iPods with
wonderful
music.
In the press, Teresa Allen, Health Promotions Manager for the American Cancer Society in Iowa, she named several factors pushing both Iowa and national mammography rates down. Most women know they should be screened, however, don't want to or are afraid to or simply don't have access to the test and just avoid the screening out of fear. Now, Lauren Rees-Flom, what do you have to say to women out there who are just fearful of going to have a breast examination, a mammography?
Well, really one word, go. You got to go, and you got to face your fear. And most mammograms are negative, and we are very fortunate actually to live in an age where breast cancer is in the process of going from being a fatal disease to a chronic one, and that is due to enormous advances in medications.
But we certainly can't have the rates of screening go down as we have in the last couple years in Iowa. You also mentioned during the break, Lauren, that when we talk about breast cancer, that's not one thing. It's several things.
Yeah, we call it breast cancer, but really it's many different diseases. And I've seen women diagnosed with breast cancer who were treated initially and have survived with no recurrence and are living their lives fully 10, 15, 20 years out. And I've also seen women get diagnosed and really get swallowed up by the disease very quickly. And I've seen women in categories in between. Mm-hmm. So it's not one thing.
How does breast cancer, being a breast cancer survivor, change your outlook on life? Is there a succinct way to say that?
I think that for me, I just shed a lot of energy that went into things that were less important. And I've learned to just go to the core of every experience in a way and really focus my energy on what feels essential.
My conversation from 2008 with Lauren Rees-Flom, along with Colleen Sell, editor of the book A Cup of Comfort for Breast Cancer Survivors. Lauren had been living with breast cancer for 17 years and died at her home in Iowa City earlier this month, surrounded by family. Lauren was a passionate fan of Lucinda Williams and followed her around the country and attended dozens of concerts. So let's go out with music from Lucinda Williams today, a song suggested by Lauren's husband, Michael. It's called Sweet Old World.
See what you lost when you left this world, this sweet old world. What you lost when you left this world, this sweet old world. The breath from your own lips, the touch of fingertips, a sweet sound of a midnight train wearing someone's ring.
River to River is produced by Alex Hoyer and Catherine Perkins. Production assistance today from Emily Woodbury. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.